Chapter 8. Airy Go Round. During the intermission, the mayor and the chief surgeon of the San Francisco General Hospital rushed to Professor Sherman's bedside to see if he was all right. "Are you tired?" they asked in one voice. "Would you rather resume tomorrow?" asked the mayor. "How do you feel?" asked the chief surgeon. "Is there anything we can do for you?" "I feel fine," said Professor Sherman. "Would you like one of the nurses to change the drinking water in your carafe?" asked the chief surgeon. "I don't care. It tastes all right to me. Could I fetch you a little refreshment?" asked the mayor. "Something to renew your strength?" "If you insist," said the professor. The mayor ran off at a fast, puffing trot while the chief surgeon busied himself tucking in the comforter around the professor's bed. It should have been obvious to anyone, even two such important personages as the mayor and chief surgeon, that all Professor Sherman wanted to do during this intermission he had called was a few minutes of rest. The mayor came back with a nip, and the professor swallowed it in one gulp. Then, looking at the mayor and surgeon, he said with a smile on his face, "You know, gentlemen, this, to me, is very funny. A little over a month ago, I was an insignificant arithmetic teacher who would have found it almost impossible to get to see either one of you. Now you are waiting on me like a pair of well-trained valets. I thank you for your kind attention. It goes to show how wonderful ballooning can be. You never can tell where the winds will blow you. What fantastic good fortune they can lead you to. Long live balloons!" he shouted. The mayor and the chief surgeon joined in with a few sheepish giggles, then backed away. By this time, the 15 minutes were up, and Professor Sherman was gratified to see that the people of the audience had quietly returned to their seats and were sitting attentively. The packed auditorium wasn't making a sound. It was waiting anxiously to hear the end of his extraordinary story. The chief surgeon saw, as before, that the professor was comfortably propped up with pillows, and the mayor walked over to the professor's bedside. With one hand resting on the head of the bed, he turned to the audience and said, "Again, it gives me great pleasure to present Professor William Waterman Sherman." The professor thanked the mayor, cleared his throat, and resumed his talk. "Mr. F. led me to the first invention he had promised to show me, the balloon merry-go-round. On our way, I told Mr. F. that the name of the invention suggested something at an amusement park. Just what is this invention for?" "It is part of an amusement park," said Mr. F., "which the children of Krakatoa are planning for themselves. You see, our children now are between the ages of 10 and 15. When we return from our trips to other countries, they help us unload our freighter with great interest. It suddenly dawned on them a year or so ago that it would be an excellent idea if a few boatloads were brought back full of supplies exclusively for them. For after all, they do own a share in the mines, too. We agreed to give them 2 boatloads a year, so all of the children held a meeting to decide how best to fill their freighters. This amusement park they have started to build is the result of their planning. The balloon merry-go-round is their own invention, designed with but little help from us. Is there any school here?" I asked. "The children have no formal schooling. We have taught them how to read and write, and we have tried to teach them a little arithmetic. They have all taken part in the building of our international houses, which is most educating in and of itself. But all in all, a school is sorely needed here. You aren't by any chance a teacher, are you? Just what does the title professor stand for in your case?" "Professor of aeronautics," I stuttered. "I teach balloon theory at the San Francisco Lighter Than Air School." I felt a flush of heat in my cheeks as I waded through this fabulous lie. I had no intention of getting involved again in teaching, the very thing from which this trip of mine was intended to take me. "How interesting," said Mr. F. "That goes to show how quickly one gets out of touch with one's native city. I can't say that I even recall hearing of such an institution." "It's one of the latest," I muttered, "practically brand new." Then, quickly changing the subject, I asked what other forms of amusement could be found at the park. "So far, they have just had time to design and build the merry-go-round, but they have a lot more planned. Most of the unusual rides found at amusement parks are impractical for Krakatoa, because they are higher than the jungle life on the island and would be visible from the sea. As a matter of fact, we only take rides on the balloon merry-go-round after thoroughly scanning the horizon for passing ships. We never use it if anything is in sight. Do you see that tall pole in the distance?" "Oh, yes, I do," I said. The pole was straight and the same width at the bottom as at the top. It was threaded like a gigantic screw, and it was about 75 feet tall. That's part of the balloon merry-go-round. The axle around which it revolves to give it its spin when it is gaining altitude. "Can't that be seen from the ocean?" I asked. "Yes, it can, but one long pole isn't enough to attract much attention from passing ships." We came to a little forest of palm trees, the same sort of neatly kept little forest I had seen the day before, with freshly cut lawn instead of the usual jungle underbrush. We walked through this forest for 100 yards or so, and then came upon a clearing. In the middle of this clearing was what was apparently the balloon merry-go-round. There were 8 little boats around the base of the pole, all joined together, bow to stern. In the place of oarlocks, there were 2 brass rings on these boats, and through these rings passed poles, which all met at the main vertical pole of the merry-go-round, where they were screwed into the hub of another large brass ring around the pole, forming spokes of a giant wheel. Each boat was covered with a protective tarpaulin. Mr. F. removed one of the tarpaulins and showed me one. They were very nice little centerboard sailboats, sturdy and quite seaworthy. The sails were neatly stowed in trim lockers. I didn't notice any masts, but there was definitely a place for them. Alongside of each of these boats was a large deflated balloon painted a pale sky blue. Off to one side in the clearing there was a little shack made of bamboo, which reminded me very much of my basket house. On its walls outside, 8 silk hoses were hanging, neatly coiled up and in line. There was a bell on top of this little shack, which could be reached by climbing a ladder. Mr. F. walked over to the shack, went inside, and came out again with a spyglass. He climbed up the ladder to the roof of the shack and carefully looked over the horizon around him, apparently for ships. "Would you care to risk a trip in it?" he asked me. "The weather today is ideal. As an ardent balloonist, I accept with enthusiasm, but as a 66-year-old man, I must confess that I accept with some trepidation. Is it safe?" "Absolutely," answered Mr. F. "You don't believe that we would allow our children to make ascensions in dangerous contraptions, do you?" "I guess not," I said, reassured. "I am sure that any invention using balloons and wind as a motive power cannot but be enjoyable." "Very well, then," said Mr. F. He then loudly rang the bell on top of the shack. This sound produced the same reaction, only considerably happier and more excited, as a school bell back at home. We were shortly surrounded by children. These children didn't seem to need to be explained anything either. As soon as they arrived in the clearing, they made themselves extremely busy readying the balloon merry-go-round. They took the tarpaulins off all the boats and rolled them up neatly. 4 of the children ran into the shack where they prepared the hydrogen machine and pumps. Another 8 grabbed a silk hose and attached it to the hydrogen machine in the shack on one end, and to one of the balloons on the other. The balloons were all carefully unfolded and laid out flat on the ground, and the nets and ropes which attached them to the boats were carefully placed around and beside them so that they wouldn't get tangled up when the balloons were filled with gas. Slowly, the balloons started to fill with hydrogen, the ones nearest the pumps filling faster than the others. They lazily lifted themselves off the ground with the children watching them carefully, constantly straightening the ropes so they wouldn't get tangled. Soon, they were all full of hydrogen and straining at the boats, which were roped to the ground. All 40 children were present, working efficiently as the merry-go-round, although it was apparent that there was only room for 14 of them on this trip. There was room for 2 in each boat, making a total of 16 seats, but Mr. F. and I were going to occupy 2 of the seats. There was no arguing among the children as to whose turn it was. They must have had some sort of passenger schedule they followed closely. I did notice that neither B1 nor B2 were among the children who climbed into the boats when they were ready. I suppose that this was because it was B-Day of the month of Lamb, and they had plenty of work to do at the British Chop Shop. I sat in a boat with Mr. F.'s son, F1, and Mr. F. sat with a child in a boat, which was on the opposite side of the big pole from ours. "This will make the merry-go-round balance better," said F1. There were 2 children on the ground near each boat. When we were all aboard, they detached the silk hydrogen hoses and rolled them back up to the shack, where they carefully hung them up. They then returned to us, and one held a rope at the bow of each boat, and the other held a rope at the boat's stern. One of the children passengers had a blank pistol, the sort used for starting races at track meets. He stood up and yelled in a high, clear voice, "Is everybody ready?" A shrill and deafening yes was heard, mixed with the deeper voices of Mr. F. and myself. At this signal, the children standing near the boats all gave their ropes a sharp pull, which seemed to unlock the boats from the ground, and they all ran around the pole in the direction we were heading, giving us a good, fast start. The boats were joined together to form the rim of a wheel. The poles going through the brass oarlocks of the boats formed the spokes of this wheel. The spokes were attached to a big brass ring or hub of the wheel, and this whole gigantic merry-go-round revolved around the 75-foot pole, which was pointing straight up to the sky and was threaded like a screw. The balloons lifted the boats around and around the huge screw up into the air. The balloon merry-go-round gained speed as it gained altitude. The pole was well greased, so that by the time we neared the top, we were going very fast. I asked F1 what happened when we reached the top of the pole. Do we quickly deflate the balloons and revolve back down to the ground around the pole in the opposite direction? "Oh, of course not," said F1. "We fly right off the pole into the air." How do we keep the wheel straight when it's in the air? You'll see, he said. We soon reached the top, and the merry-go-round lunged upward as it lost its grip on the pole. The wind immediately started to carry us off over the island. We were gaining altitude fast and, of course, still spinning around with great speed. I must admit, this was a truly delightful and exciting ride, unlike any other balloon experience I have ever had. I saw now how the boats were kept level. A child in each boat held the ripcord of his boat's balloon. Whenever a boat went a little higher than the others, the ripcord would be pulled, releasing a little hydrogen until the boat was again on the same level. You must only be able to take short trips, I told F1, if you constantly have to release gas to keep the merry-go-round level. That's right, he answered. The length of our trips depends on many things, such as the calmness of the weather, how well we distribute the weight in the boats, and how skillfully we control the ripcords. But you understand, he added, the balloon merry-go-round wasn't built for travel, but rather for short pleasure trips. Oh, of course, I said. The balloon merry-go-round was heading directly for the mountain. I saw that we were going to fly over it. I asked F1 if this were not dangerous. It isn't dangerous, but it's rather unfortunate because it always means a short trip. Why? I asked. Because the huge crater of the volcanic mountain is full of hot air, which forms sort of a vacuum. When we fly over the crater, the merry-go-round is sucked downward rather violently, and we always use up a lot of gas controlling it and keeping it level. Isn't that hazardous? I asked. No, said F1. By the time we reach the mountain, we will be high enough to clear it by a great distance. The only danger in taking a ride in this is landing on the ground or on the mountain, or worst of all, in the mountain when the wind is calm. Krakatoa is a small island, and if there is any wind at all, it will carry the merry-go-round out to sea. Once, when we first got it, we took a trip on a very calm day. We went straight up, spun around a while, and gradually lost altitude, landing in a forest of palm trees. No one was hurt, but some of the boats were damaged, and one of the balloons was torn. Since then, we have only risked trips when there is wind. We were nearing the mountain, and I leaned over the side of my boat to look down at the crater. There was a thick gray smoke crawling around inside. It was like looking into a horrible pit full of elephants. When we were directly over the mountain, there was a sickening atmosphere of hot air permeated with sulfurous gases. The merry-go-round started tossing around violently over the pit, and the children with the ripcords kept a careful watch directly across our giant wheel at opposite boats to keep the merry-go-round as steady and level as possible. Hanging on tightly, I leaned over the side of the boat in order to have a direct look into the volcanic crater itself. In places where the smoke had cleared a bit, I could see a lake of thick molten lava, boiling and bubbling in slow motion. It was a sickening, frightening sight. As I was leaning over, the merry-go-round suddenly plunged downward, then swayed from side to side as the children steadied it. I must have taken a deep gasp of breath out of fear, I suppose, and my lungs were suddenly filled with hot, sulfurous fumes. The merry-go-round was still spinning fast, as well as pitching and rocking in the air. I hastily drew my head back into the boat, shut my eyes, and lay down on the bottom of the boat. I could hear the rumbling of the mountain beneath me, mixed with the hissing noise of hydrogen being released from the balloons. I think I was as close to being sick then as it is possible for anyone to be. We were soon over the mountain and in fresh, calm air again, and I sat up feeling considerably better. To tell you the truth, sir, said F1, who apparently could well see that I had nearly lost my British breakfast, I was nearly sick myself that time. The mountain seems unusually violent this morning. I hope this isn't a bad sign. I took this to be the remark of a younger balloonist comforting an older one who had nearly made a fool of himself. I told him that my behavior was quite inexcusable. Flying over water in the spinning airship was completely enjoyable. The magnificent seascape of the Pacific Ocean passed before your eyes half of the time, and Krakatoa in its entirety was beneath you for your careful observation with each turn of the merry-go-round. The island looked beautiful from the air. Its vegetation was so rich, warm, and soft-looking. The mountain looked so fearful and exciting. The magnificent houses of all nations looked like extraordinary dolls' houses on felt lawns, and the Krakatoan crystal house shone like a jewel. The contrast between the trimmed interior and the untrimmed ring of jungle around the island was easy to see from our boats. The island looked like a formal garden surrounded by a bushy, untrimmed hedge. After a flight lasting approximately 35 minutes, we were near the surface of the water. The children, controlling their ripcords like experts, lowered the merry-go-round gently and smoothly into the ocean. We made one complete turn in the water and came slowly to a stop. "Well," I exclaimed, "that was undoubtedly the most thrilling and unusual trip I have ever had the pleasure of taking." The children in the boats, Mr. F. and I then, all leaned back and relaxed a while in the sun, looking up at the balloons, which were now half empty and bobbing back and forth in the wind. Suddenly, one of the boys, the same one who had fired the starting gun, stood up and said, "All right, everybody, let's go." At this command, the rest of the children stood up and carefully deflated their balloons and folded them up in their boats without letting any part of them touch the water. They folded them lengthwise first, then rolled them from the top toward the bottom where the gas escape was, thus forcing all of the air out of them and making some small neat bundles. They opened the little lockers in the boats where the sails were, took the sails out, and replaced them with the folded balloons. Each boat had one mainsail. "How do you sail these boats when they are all attached together like a wheel?" I asked. "And what do you use for masts?" These were foolish questions, I immediately realized, for while I was asking them, I managed to figure out these problems for myself. First of all, the children detached the boats, one from the other, at their bows and sterns. When this was done, they were still attached to each other by the poles which formed the spokes of the giant wheel. These poles were obviously the masts when the boats were used for sailing. The children, two on each pole, all pushed together toward the center hub until the poles slid out through the brass oar lock rings on their boats. Then, still working two on each pole, they unscrewed the poles from the brass hub in the center. They all unscrewed their poles except one boy, the boy who gave the commands. He pulled his pole in with the hub still attached to it, unscrewed the hub in his boat, and put it away in a separate locker. Now that they each had their masts, it was a simple problem to put them into the mast holes. Mr. F. and I did our best to work as efficiently as any of the other crew members. Soon the mainsail was rigged up and we were ready to sail back to the island. Only the need for a boom was absent from this compact invention. We lowered the centerboards and lined up. It was evidently the custom to race home. The boy who gave the signals took out his gun, fired it, and we were homeward bound as fast as the wind would take us. I am afraid I was more of a hindrance than a capable assistant to young F1. We finished the race last by about 7 minutes. The boats were moored to a dock near the freighter in the hidden inlet, and we assembled on shore. F1 explained to me that the boy who had given the signals was the captain of the day, some sort of honor each child received in turn. The captain of the day told the rest of us that since this was my first trip in the balloon merry-go-round, the results of the boat race wouldn't count on the official scoring sheet. F1 let out a whooping cheer at this, which made me feel quite badly. The captain of the day then took me aside and told me in a most polite way that he thought it would be an excellent idea if I learned a bit about sailing, since I now found myself to be a citizen of Krakatoa. I assured him that I would. The captain of the day then closed the meeting by saying that the merry-go-round would be reassembled around the flying pole right after supper. "And I want you all to be here and help," he said, looking sternly in my direction. After 40 years of school teaching, I found myself being ordered about by a child. I couldn't help but find this heretofore impossible turnabout amusing. I was indeed far away from the usual dull school routines I so disliked. "I'll be there," I said in a loud voice as everybody looked at me and laughed. The whole trip had taken about 5 hours, and we had therefore missed lunch. I devoured an excellent supper at the B's Chop House, and then Mr. F. and I reported to the flying pool. The captain of the day rang the bell on top of the shack, assembling all the children, and we were divided into 8 groups of 5. B1 and B2 were still busy. With 5 on each boat, we had the merry-go-round reassembled and ready to go in less than half an hour. I will confess, though, that after this busy second day on the fabulous island, I was well ready for bed and slept like a top.